Dudes, Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're cooking with fruit. Meet the author of a new cookbook that celebrates fruit here in the Midwest. First, any bookworm might tell you that the book is always better than the movie. How could a film ever capture all the nuance and detail you get on the page? Well, our next guest, who reads and writes about books for a living, says that some movies just outshine the books that they're based on. We're talking about movies and TV shows adapted from books, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like to read the book first before you see its film or TV version, or do you go back and read a book after you've seen it as a movie or TV show? And what are some of your favorite movies and TV shows based on books? Are there ones you wish would be turned into a movie? Are there ones you've regretted the movie version of? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Olivia Rutigliano is the associate editor of the Crime Reads section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. She's also a PhD candidate in entertainment history at Columbia University. Olivia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. There's a lot of challenges that go from taking a book, especially a beloved book, and turning it into a movie. What are some of the pitfalls that a really good adaptation can avoid?
This is a great question. I think we've been struggling to answer that for many decades. I think the first thing is to weigh the question of narrative fidelity. How important is it to include every minute detail, or is it more important to derive elements from the essence of the work on the whole and transform it into something new? I think a good adaptation often walks the balance between the two while understanding that a new medium like film or TV is not going to be able to do everything that the original book or source material does and work within those boundaries.
In a recent feature at Lit Hub, you shared some of your personal favorites. I want to give a listen to one. I mean, a lot of people think of this as one of the best movies of all time. Here's a taste.
Now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, and give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me Godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder.
All right, great movie. And you say a much, much better movie than the book. How so?
Well, I think The Godfather, the book, which is written by Mario Puzo in 1969, it's a great book. It introduces us to the Corleone family, and we will always be grateful to Puzo for doing that. But I think the screenplay of The Godfather actually provides an edit of the book that gets us a more economical and very charged version. And Mario Puzo co-wrote the screenplay, which he based off the book, but he co-wrote it with Coppola, who had his own thoughts about how to mold it into a movie. And the two of them edited the original source text together. And that's why I think it works well. It has the true essence of the book through the author's involvement, but it also has a sense of where to cut and where not to cut from an outsider's perspective.
Now, I got to admit, I've never directly read the book, but I double checked the story with my mom. She was reading The Godfather when she went into labor with me.
Oh my God.
So I figure I must, like, I like cannolis, but I think that's all I've taken away from it. So is it, if I like the movie, do you think it's worth it for me to go back and actually read the book myself?
This is a good question. I mean, I always think it's worth to read the book, if only because it enriches the experience of watching the movie to know what was included and what wasn't. I have similar thoughts about Jaws, which I think is a much better movie than it is a book. I apologize to Peter Benchley. but I always think that reading the book can't do you wrong.
All right, here's a little listen to Jaws, because that was another one you talked about in your piece.
Yes.
Shark! The shark!
Michael's in the pond.
All right, a little taste of the ominous music there. Now, if I'm not mistaken, once again, the author, Peter Benchley, was involved in writing the screenplay?
Yes, he was. Peter Benchley co-wrote the screenplay for Jaws with Carl Gottlieb. And I mean, the thing about the book Jaws is that it tries to do so much, and I don't necessarily think it pulls off everything. But the movie was whittled down to a really fantastic three-act structure. There's clear character development, and a lot of the murky stuff that the characters deal with or are imbued in those characters in the book go away. Like in the book, Matt Hooper has an affair. Matt Hooper's the character played by Richard Dreyfuss. He has an affair with Chief Brody's wife, and he's actually not a great guy. And I won't tell you what happens to him at the end, but I mean, he is governed by hubris so much. And paring that down and having him be Richard Dreyfuss's sort of nerdy scientist who's able to advocate for the shark without getting in the way of Chief Brody's personal life and impeding Brody's own arc is, I think, a very smart way to trim that character down.
We're talking about book-to-movie adaptations or book-to-TV. Olivia Rutigliano is with us. She's written about this and many other topics. You can find her work at Lit Hub, and she's a PhD candidate in entertainment history at Columbia University. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite book-to-movie or TV show adaptation where they think they got it right, maybe even better than the book? Or was there one that you were excited about and it let you down? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Olivia, here's one you recently wrote about, a long-awaited adaptation of a Judy Blume book, the classic Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. A half-century wait for it to be turned into a movie. What was it worth it? Was it worth the wait?
Oh, it was. It was wonderful. I just saw it a few days ago, so I'm really able to talk about it. It's fresh in my mind. Yes, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was written in 1970. It's about a young girl, an 11-year-old, who moves from New York City to New Jersey. And in her new school has a new group of friends who are very worried about growing up or if they're growing up enough. And a lot of the book is about Margaret's own experiences, understanding herself, understanding her body's changes, but also her relationship to her parents and religion and God, and most dramatically. And these are very, very weighty themes, especially for a book that's aimed at preteens. And so Judy Blume did not sell the rights for 49 years until she found the right people she felt would adapt it with respect and make a progressive, thoughtful adaptation out of it. And she found the right people in Kelly Freeman Craig and James L. Brooks, who made the new movie. And it manages to keep the reverent, respectful, but also funny, curious tone of the book without sacrificing any of the important themes or the really useful work that it does in representing girlhood and all of the things that go along with it.
Okay, now, I mean, I grew up reading Judy Blume. This is a cherished memory, those books, for a lot of kids. Were you nervous about a movie having a go at this one, even with the Judy Blume seal of approval on it?
Oh, I was so nervous. My gosh. Every time a childhood adaptation gets turned into something, I freak out. I was also nervous about last year's Catherine Colberti, which is actually a very similar book, very similar movie. It's also about a preteen girl coming to terms with things, especially about her own status and her body, et cetera. But that takes place in the Middle Ages, and Lena Dunham adapted that one. Just like when I showed up to the movie theater to see Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I was almost shivering. I was so nervous. But this one turned out to be really wonderful. And one of the ways that it was wonderful was that it wisely understood that not only children were going to watch this movie, the book might have its main audience in 11-year-olds, but the movie is going to be seen by a lot of people, including their parents, who take them to it, or older siblings, younger siblings. So this one actually had wide multi-generational appeal, and it cultivated that by expanding the plot to include a lot of detail about Margaret's mom, who is played by Rachel McAdams. So the two actually become parallel figures in this movie, and it's a really nice way to modernize it and update it, but also cater to an audience who might be moms, preteens, somewhere in between or elsewhere on the spectrum.
We have many callers. Let's bring on Don in Union Center. Don, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just I think in general, a lot of the time the book is better than the movie. But I and one quick example is I'm originally from Trenton, New Jersey, and I really got a laugh out of the Janet Ivanovich Stephanie Plum books. And I never saw the movie, but I heard that was a dog. But as far as movies better than books, I've always liked Dr. Zhivago. And then I read the book and I thought the book was way too much stuff. The movie was a lot more streamlined, a lot more focused. Just the book was real complicated, if you want to say. So anyway, that's just the biggest example in my mind. Dr. Zhivago, I thought, was a lot better than the book.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Don. And that's kind of the same premise, Olivia, you were talking about with The Godfather. It takes, maybe it streamlined it from the book to the movie.
Yes, I think so. Although Dr. Zhivago might actually be longer than The Godfather. So, and having never read the book, Dr. Zhivago, I wonder how long that must be, actually. but yes, I think that's very similar.
Thanks a lot for that recommendation. We're talking about movies and TV shows that are better than the books they're based on. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, associate editor of the Crime Reads section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there any movie or TV adaptations you think did a terrible job of representing the books they're based on, or ones that got it right, maybe even better than the book? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about movies and maybe TV shows that are better than the books they're based on. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, associate editor of the Crime Reads section and senior film writer at Lit Hub. You can join in with your suggestions or anti-suggestions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you got for us?
Well, a book that I wouldn't consider a great book, but it was a very pleasurable read, was Where the Crawdads Sing by Della Owens. And I thought the movie version enhanced the book. I thought the two just were, should be one read and the other watched.
And what was it about the movie that you liked even better than the book?
It fleshed out some of the characters that the book kind of left a little bit more. I don't know what the word I'm thinking of is.
Sort of background characters, maybe.
Yeah.
Interesting. Barbara, thanks a lot for sharing that. That's interesting, Olivia, because in this case, you know, a couple we talked about, Godfather, Dr. Zhivago, our caller thought, hey, it took out some extraneous stuff. It streamlined it. Sometimes people are liking movies better because it fleshed out some of the stuff that was left unexplored in the book.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I mean, do you think that's a common approach?
That's a very good question. I definitely think that sometimes when we read a book, we want more from it. A wise adaptation might give us a lot more to work with. I think one of those examples might actually be William Goldman's The Princess Bride, a book which is excellent, but a movie that knowingly expands certain elements while also maintaining pretty tight textual fidelity. I think sometimes one of the issues is knowing when to stop adding things. When we're turning books into miniseries, how many seasons should we play with? How many seasons should we add on if the first one is successful? Questions like that, I think, should govern these conversations. Sometimes less is more.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to give a listen to another movie you wrote about. This is a clip from Tim Burton's 2003 film, Big Fish.
They say when you meet the love of your life, time stops. And that's true. What they don't tell you is that once time starts again, it moves extra fast to catch up.
Sounds like a Tim Burton film. It's based on the novel by Daniel Wallace. The novel, I guess, is a tribute and reaction to The Odyssey and James Joyce's Ulysses. What is it about that one that made the movie better than the book to you?
Well, Daniel Wallace's Big Fish is a great book. It's a novel about a man's relationship with his father, and it is wonderful. However, I saw the movie first, I will admit, and I was so enchanted by Tim Burton's particularly surreal realization of that. Tim Burton is suited really well, I think, to movies that have a hint of realism, but tip, you know, into fantasy or wild adventures, not too much. I don't want to be taken away to a fantasy world by Tim Burton entirely, but I want the real world to be injected with something magical by Tim Burton. And it's like a picaresque story. It's about this young man getting to know his father through a lifetime of his father's stories. And so the flashbacks that take us to these many adventures as they're narrated by the character of the father, who is played by Albert Finney in the present day and who's played by Ewan McGregor in flashbacks, get to be visually full of the kind of possible exaggeration that, you know, all the really good storytellers we know inject into their stories. So the way that the film is handled visually and sonically pairs really well with the figure of a larger than life raconteur or narrator storyteller who regales us and who you wonder might not be telling the truth, but you don't care. So I thought the visual way Tim Burton was able to navigate that was really masterful. That's what made it special.
We've got some more recommendations from our listeners at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jerry in West Bend. Jerry, hi.
Hi.
What's
I wanted to tell you, Rob and Olivia, that this is a wonderful idea for a program. I have been a voracious reader for my lifetime. And one of the books I read was Papillon, The Butterfly. And I read it probably 20 or 30 years ago. And a few years later, I came across the book, and I was very disappointed.
Across the movie, you mean?
I came across the movie.
Okay.
I went to see the movie because I had been so, I had enjoyed the book so much. And it turned out that what they did is, in the movie, they had the main character have events that happened to four or five different people in the book.
Oh.
All happened. Character.
Jerry, thanks a lot for that story. Have you had that experience, Olivia, with, you know, that movie you're anticipating from a book you liked, and there was some kind of decision like that that just ruined it for you?
You know, one thing that I'm thinking about is actually the new Great Expectations series that aired on FX/Hulu. The Great Expectations is a novel I absolutely love, and I've reread many times over the years. I'm a big Dickens fan. And that adaptation was startling. It was startling how much was moved around, condensed, and straight up invented. To the point where I didn't recognize it anymore.
Wow.
So I wouldn't say it's the exact same thing of having multiple characters condensed into one, but it did condense, let's say, 300 years worth of action adventure into the experiences of a single character who often doesn't deal with many of those things in the book. So I was a bit unmoored, let's say, by that decision.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jerry. We're talking about book to movie or book to TV adaptations. Olivia Rutigliano is with us, and we're looking at the ones where the movie did it better or maybe the book did. Back to your calls with Susie in Williams Bay. Hi, Susie.
Yeah, I'm going to say To Kill a Mockingbird.
Are you saying movie better than book?
I think they're both great.
Oh, okay. Oh, that was the one where you liked the book and the movie didn't let you down.
Right. I haven't read the book since high school, and I have seen the movie lots of times on DVD, and I think they're both excellent.
Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that one. Olivia, she likes them both, though it's been a while in the book. Is that one a movie you want to weigh in on?
Yeah, I think those are actually frequently referenced in conversations, articles, where the book is just as good as the movie is just as good as the book. They're both masterpieces. And of course, you know, Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch is one of the most indelible figures in cinema history. An actor, Harper Lee, initially didn't want to play Atticus Finch because she thought he was too dashing, too handsome, and it took some convincing, allegedly. So sometimes even the author is a bit dubious about some of the ways that a text will be realized in real life. But I agree. I think the book and the film both are extraordinarily impressive and very effective in what they set out to do.
Thanks a lot for that call. Maurice joins us now in Madison. Maurice, hi.
How you doing? So my movie is On the Beach with Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner and Fred Astaire in a dramatic role. It's about the surviving people after a nuclear war. The only people left are in Australia, and they're dying off, mm-hmm. too. I didn't read the book, but my point is that it's like comparing apples and oranges because it's a different experience. The emotion that was brought by those characters, I don't think the book could have done that. I remember the author's name is Neville Shute.
Neville Shute, yeah.
And I guess it's a good book. I'll have to read it finally.
Well, Maurice, thanks a lot for the call. I've read the book. It's a great book. Really bummed me out. I didn't want to live through that experience again, honestly.
Yeah.
Olivia, you were nodding along. I think I heard on some of what Maurice had to say, though, on the apples and oranges there.
Yeah, I think they're extremely different. I think the book, On the Beach is a post-apocalyptic movie from the late 50s. And I think in the novel, there's the war starts without any nation being at fault. I think it's more about the destruction of the world and the survivors as opposed to a specific global conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that differs than in the book. I think the movie is very much about the global politics that lead up to the war and the destruction of the world.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for that call. Olivia, I was just thinking you mentioned authors who don't like where the movie is going. I visited Anne Rice's grave in New Orleans earlier this year. She famously hated the idea of Tom Cruise playing her main character and then took out a full-page Variety ad saying, I love Tom Cruise as my main character. Thoughts on that one as we wrap up?
Yes, I think that's one of the famous conversion stories of an author initially not liking the character and then going to like it. I mean, when you write a book and you see someone else realize it, you can have many different reactions. I think Emily St. John Mandel, the writer, has said that she believes other people might actually have better versions of her story than she does.
Wow.
But that's not necessarily shared by every author. And sometimes when you put your heart and soul into a book, you create a character who is, so captivating. It's very hard to see someone you didn't initially envision in that position. I don't know. I know one of the great adaptations is Field of Dreams, which is not on the list and which is I forgot to include when we were doing our roundup. I didn't think of it and I should have. But W.P. Kinsella, the author of the book Shoeless Joe, on which Field of Dreams is based, actually based the character of Ray Kinsella on himself. I mean, how does an adaptation process work when someone's doing it, when the character is based on you?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Olivia Rutigliano. We've been talking about films and TV shows adapted from books. Food Friday is up next with Fruit. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Dominion Voting Systems settled a defamation lawsuit against Fox News this week for nearly $800 million. We'll talk to an expert on media law about the case and what the settlement means for the future of Fox News and the media in general. Now, as the weather warms up in Wisconsin, we're looking forward to a steady parade of fruit, from rhubarb to berries to apples and a lot more. And on this edition of Food Friday, our guest says there's a lot we can do with fruit in the kitchen, from sweet and simple desserts to salads to savory entrees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite dish to make and or eat that uses fruit? Salads, desserts, main courses, you name it. Or do you have a question about how to use some kind of fruit in your cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Abra Behrens is a chef, former farmer, and writer based in Michigan. Her new book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. Abra, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much for having me. I was saying earlier, I love public radio so much, so it's always a treat to get to talk to you all.
Fantastic. Well, it's good to have you back. Now, I love, you talk about the reaction from your friends when you were talking about writing this book, and a lot of them were like, it's fruit, you just eat it. Why do we need to cook with it? What was your reaction? What led you from that to actually writing the book?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about the fruit cookbook for probably going on 10 years, because someone who attended a farm dinner I was hosting a while back sort of noted that there was a lot of fruit in the savory courses. And it hadn't really occurred to me that that was out of the ordinary until that person said it. And so then as I was kind of researching the book and thinking about what people needed out of a fruit cookbook, yeah, it was like 50-50. My friend said, why would I need a cookbook? You just eat it. And then the other 50% said, oh, I never buy fruit because I don't know what to do with it. And so it seemed like it was kind of a happy medium that we could find. And that was the idea, was to really give people a lot of options, both for baking things, but then really all of these savory dishes as well.
One thing I love about this book is, you know, you're in Michigan, we're in Wisconsin, we have a similar fruit palette here. You're not telling us to go in the backyard and pick Meyer lemons off of our tree or anything like that. You are really a fan of the abundance of fruit in Michigan and the Midwest. Can you talk about that a little?
It's true. And Wisconsin grows a ton of fruit, not quite as much as Michigan. We're the second most agriculturally diverse state in the nation, but Wisconsin is close behind. And you guys have, you know, just as many cherries in a lot of ways and amazing apples and all of those things. So I really wanted to, in all of these books, Roughage, my first book, and Grist are all really featured on ingredients grown here in the Midwest because there's so many of them. And, it, you know, as much as I love eating pineapple, I don't really cook with it that often because we don't have it in the abundance that we have some of our other items. So I left that for somebody else to write about, but we're really focusing on the kind of primary 20-25 ingredients that are grown here in the upper northern Midwest.
And in those other books and now in Pulp, it's not just a cookbook. You interview farmers, people with orchards and other cooks in some cases. And you talk about, you know, all farming brings unique challenges. Growing fruit has some very unique ones in that, you know, if I plant cucumbers this spring, I can eat cucumbers later in the summer. Fruit is a multi-year endeavor. Could you talk about some of what you heard from the Michigan farmers you talked to?
Yeah, you know, everything that was written about before is pretty much an annual. So you plant the seed, grow it, harvest it, and eat it right then. And perennial crops really have this added layer of complexity with regard to their overhead. So on average, for a cherry tree to come to full capacity, it's about 7 years from when the tree is planted. And that, you know, that doesn't mean it's 7 years just sitting in a barn somewhere. There's still, you know, mowing and tending and pruning and all those things that need to happen. And apple trees can last, you know, hundreds of years. And so they're really big investments. So one of the things that I was wanting to convey to non-growers is just the nature of what it means to have that overhead and to really be managing that type of crop, both with regard to climate collapse and decisions that people are making for the next, you know, 30 years to 50 years, but also just in terms of the different scales and markets. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Traverse City area that grows a ton of cherries. And it occurred to me one day driving around that I don't know how many of our visitors realize that those aren't going to a farmer's market. You know, most of those cherries are going into something like cherry pie filling or tart cherry concentrate or, you know, cherry barbecue sauce, things like that. And so there's several different markets that really affect how a farm runs. And I guess for me, I just believe that to really love food, you have to know a little bit about how it's grown or at least appreciate the work that goes into bringing it to market. So that's the idea behind the interviews.
And you're a fan of getting local produce when possible, not just, you know, in general or for its own sake. You really like being able to meet the farmers and experiencing the variety that that local farmer can provide. What have you gained from your contact with local farmers for on the fruit book and your other ones?
So many times I go to a market or, you know, somewhere, even to a grocery store. You know, the people that work in grocery stores are seeing this food day in and day out. And just by simply asking them what they're excited about right now, you have a better chance of getting turned on to something that is either tasting perfect or is new and exciting. And the entire ground cherry chapter in Pulp was really kind of inspired by the fact that I didn't know what a ground cherry was until I started working here at Grainer Farm. And it was the grower here that was like so excited about them and wanted me to taste them. And so tasting it was like, oh, there's this whole new ingredient that I get to work with and, you know, really kind of decide how I want to weave it into the dishes that we make.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Abra Behrens. Her new book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit that we could see here in the Midwest. Not a lot of citrus here, but a lot of variety. She's in Michigan. We're in Wisconsin. Do you have favorites? Do you have a question for our guest about what to do with all the blank that maybe grows on a tree in your backyard, or you can get a lot of it at your local grocery or farmer's market? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Abra, you mentioned savory dishes. I think people might not always think of a lot of fruit ending up there. Before getting into some specific recipes, can you talk about the joy of using fruit in, you know, in our meals, our savory meals?
Well, I grew up in a household that was very much, you know, pork chops and applesauce, and maybe there's a salad on the side. My mom was an incredible cook, but that was definitely something that we had in our rotation. So maybe that's where it started. But the idea is that, you know, fruit has some natural acidity. It has sweetness to it, things like that. And so it's able to really cut through the richness of some of the richer meats like pork and lamb and duck, but also things like cheeses, any sort of like, there's a salad in the book that is cucumbers, melons, and chickpeas with a buttermilk dressing. So you've got that richness from the chickpeas and from the buttermilk, and the melon just really rounds it all out. So it lends lots of color, lots of a little bit of sweetness and some acidity that kind of balances out a dish.
Now, you've shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Ginger poached apricots over salmon. This one sounds really good. I like salmon. I don't think I would have thought of putting apricots on it. What are they doing there?
Well, I really love using the lake fish. And so this is also really good with lake trout or the salmon that we produce here in the Midwest. And the salmon is very simply steamed with some choy. And then the apricots are poached with a really flavorful liquid. And, you know, apricots are always kind of that mysterious fruit where we often don't get them because they bloom really early and they get nipped by frost. But when we do have them, they're just so perfect. And it's such a short season. So this is a way that you can kind of take even a less than perfect apricot, poach it, add a little bit of that extra flavor in the ginger, and then the sweetness sort of balances the fattiness of that salmon. Plus, they're both that beautiful blush color, and so they look stunning together on the plate. And the ginger kind of pulls it all together, as does the chili oil that's spooned over the top. The chili oil just, you know, again, cuts through that richness of the salmon, counterbalances the sweetness in the apricots, and lends just a little bit of spice to it.
And mentioning those less than perfect looking apricots reminds me another theme of your book is, well, this piece of fruit doesn't maybe look so great right now. I don't want to just take a bite out of it, but we can cut back on our waste by finding ways to incorporate it in our cooking.
Yeah, you know, fruit is always sort of frustrating for people, myself included, because sometimes it looks so perfect and so good, and then you taste it and the yep. flavor is a little meh. And so that's when I feel like we have an opportunity as cooks to really kind of exert our own influence on it. And so most fruit, if you roast it or grill it or cook it down, you are concentrating the flavors by removing some of that extra moisture. Something like poaching it allows you to add some other flavors to it as well. And it gets sort of perfumed by the aromatics that are in that poaching liquid. There's also a ton of recipes for just raw preparations. And that's when you've got a perfect strawberry, you don't have to mess with it. Just the recipe in the book is a beet carpaccio. So it's roasted beets sliced really thinly, strawberries sliced over the top, a nice acidic vinaigrette, and then some candied fennel seeds and some herbs and edible flowers. And it's just stunning. So if the fruit is looking great, then just let it shine.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Abra Behrens about her new book. It's called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit available here in the Midwest, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite dessert to make with a kind of local fruit, or do you use it in cooking and salads? Do you have questions about how to use blank? Rhubarb is on the way. We're going to talk about that. Do you have rhubarb favorites or questions? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Abra Behrens, chef, former farmer, and writer based in Michigan, talking about her new book, Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit, focusing on fruits of the Midwest. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions or favorites to cook with anything on the fruit alphabet, apples, berries, cherries, the rest of them, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Find some recipes from Abra at WPR.org/Food Friday. We had a question from Rebecca in Manitowoc who couldn't stay on the line. Rebecca called in to ask her a ground cherry recipe. Rebecca says she usually eats them straight up, but would like to try something new. Abra, you were just talking about those ground cherries. What kind of things do you like to do with them?
My favorite ground cherry recipe in the book is a whole head of cauliflower that's roasted with ground cherries in the pan with the cauliflower. And so they burst and they reduce their liquid, and you just spoon that liquid over the head of cauliflower. And then you finish it with a little bit of thyme, which is a garlic sauce that's really quick to make. And then it has a little bit of cashews on it and some parsley. So that's a really great full main course. I mean, that with a salad is a full dinner in my household, and it gets kind of sticky and sweet and a little bit tangy and a little bit garlicky. On the sweet side, I tend to cook ground cherries down a little if I'm not just going to eat them raw, which is like such a delicious way to have them. I usually saute them down a little bit and make kind of like a half jam, half chutney, and then spoon that over something like biscuits with some fresh butter. It goes really well with cheeses, things like that.
I hope that helps, Rebecca. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Abra, rhubarb is just around the corner. I got a plant planted by a previous owner before I moved into a house. I always get a lot of rhubarb out of it. Do you point out, you know, in the biology lab, rhubarb's technically a vegetable, but in the kitchen, hey, it's a fruit. What are some of your favorite things to do with rhubarb?
The rhubarb, I've been poaching it a lot lately. I feel like poaching kind of fell out of favor, you know, in the 80s when everybody was poaching chicken breasts and nobody was happy about it. But it's a really wonderful technique, and it's something you can just simmer the big chunks of rhubarb in a really flavorful liquid, and then it's a little bit tangy and sweet and soft and supple, and it goes really well. I have a recipe in there for a cream puff that is then filled with the poached rhubarb. And the first half of the cookbook is what I call the baker's toolkit. And that is a collection of almost 100 recipes that I've collected over the years, either in my own work or when I've worked next to a great pastry chef and they've lent me the recipe. And then they all kind of can mix and match and pair with fruit in different ways. So I really love that rhubarb and cream puff combination.
And I do make a lot of crisp because it's super easy and hard to mess up. But I do apple rhubarb crisp and things like that. I've done rhubarb bars, kind of like lemon bars. The curse is you got to be careful. Rhubarb's really tart. Like, how do you make sure? And I feel like I'm adding a lot of sugar here and it still ends up being pretty tart. How do we calibrate that?
Yeah, I mean, I love the combination of apple and rhubarb because I feel like it's always nice when the end of one season butts up right against the start of another. So the apples will lend some sweetness to it. The other way that I like to get some of that sweetness, or at least mimic some of the sweetness, is to, you can sear it, and that will give you that kind of nice, deep, caramelized flavor without having to add extra sugar. And it kind of helps take the liquid out, and so it concentrates it again. So I like doing that sometimes. I also eat rhubarb raw a lot. There's a dish, speaking of salmon, there's a raw rhubarb salad with poached fish in it, and I just love that combination. And then you can kind of just embrace the tartness, slice it super thinly, have it raw, and it'll kind of pucker up the salad for you.
Now, here's another recipe you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Uses up a couple of ingredients that might still be left over from the fall, a celery root, or celeriac, they call it, and tart apples. You call it a snowmelt stew. Pretty good creative name. Tell us, this is a combination I would not have anticipated. Tell us about that.
Yeah, celery root is another sort of underlauded vegetable. And I love it in, you know, December and January when you're getting into those storage root crops. And it has just the perfect amount of starch in it that when you blend it into a soup, it makes a very silky soup without having to add any flour or anything like that. And yet it I mean, it's celery, so it has that kind of tannicness that celery often has. And the apples just balance that out. So you sweat the onions and a little bit of garlic and the celery root and the apples together, add your liquid to it, bring it up and let it simmer until everything is really soft, and then blitz it in the blender. And you're right about the name. That name is a fully made up, just kind of silly name, because when I would put on the restaurant menu apple celery root soup, it didn't sell. But snow melt stew, that people can't buy enough of that.
Talking to Abra Behrens, her latest book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit from the Midwest. She's in Michigan. We have a lot of the same fruit here in Wisconsin. All right, let's get into something that kind of surprised me. Maybe it shouldn't. You'd share ideas for pickling our fruit.
Yeah, I love pickling things. You know, some things like apples and pears, I'll pickle with just a normal pickle liquid recipe because they oftentimes have a firm enough flesh that they can stand up to that liquid. The other thing I like to do is a very restauranty thing called make a gastrique, which is you make a dark caramel, and I take it pretty dark so that it's, you know, smoking and not overly sweet, because you kind of caramelized all of that sugar down, and then you add vinegar to it, and that's what deglazes and softens and dissolves the hard caramel. And then that liquid is like both very sweet and very tangy. And then I just pour that liquid over something like raspberries or blueberries or even cherries, anything like that. And it just really amplifies the inherent sweet and sourness of the fruit and makes it acidic enough that you can spoon it over super rich things. And it almost functions like a dressing on a salad. Or there's a recipe in the book that has a roasted carrot dish with pickled raspberries that I really love.
I guess it shouldn't surprise me that much, because it's been a while, but I've made an apple chutney, which is basically a particular form of a pickled fruit, right?
It is. And it's funny. My dad was just over. He attended a dinner here at Grainer Farm that we did based on the book. And he pointed out that there are not enough chutneys in the book. That's how he really likes fruit. So you can't win them all. But yes, chutney is very much of that same ilk.
Now, let's talk about, you know, in the summer, of course, we're going to eat lots of salads. You've already touched on a couple of the things that are very salad-like. I think one of your recipes has a quote-unquote salad in the name. Share some of your favorite ways to use those summertime fruits in salads.
You know, a lot of times in the summer for a salad, I'll just keep things really simple and use the fruit just raw. One of my favorite kind of late summer salads is a salad with grapes and fennel and butter lettuce. And then it's dressed really simply just with buttermilk. And I've used buttermilk in that way a lot because it has, you know, the perfect balance to me of a fattiness from the milk itself and then a tang from it being cultured. And you don't have to mess with adding olive oil and vinegar and mustard and all the things that are normally in a dressing. So it makes it super fast. It's really easy and very, very just surprising and delicious. There's also a blueberry salad that's dressed with buttermilk that has some oat groats in it for a little bit of texture, and then lots of different types of greens. So it really depends on which one you're kind of after, but you can load up all sorts of different fruits into any kind of salad.
I want to turn the clock forward a little bit to apple season. You know, at grocery stores, you might have a couple few choices. If you hit the orchards or the farmer's market, you might have a lot more. How do we figure out the right tool for the right job, the right apple for a particular dish we're making?
It's a hard one. And that's where I think having the opportunity to talk to a grower, talk to the people at the grocery store really helps, because they can direct you in one direction or another. Most of the time, I'm looking for a very tart apple. Especially if I'm going to be baking with it or doing any sort of preparation. If I'm eating it out of hand, I might buy a sweeter apple. But generally, I just ask, what's the tartest and what's going to hold together? You know, I did a lot of my culinary training in Ireland and the UK, and they separate between baking apples and floury apples. And a floury apple will just immediately fall apart as soon as it's cooked. But it has, you know, it's perfect for like an applesauce or something like that. But a baking apple will hold its shape. And so if you ask a grower, they're going to know how they use it. Because most of the time, fruit growers are using that fruit in their own kitchens as well.
And just a half minute left, we're at the end. So let's ask about dessert, your favorite fruit dessert.
I think my favorite, it's a hard one, but my favorite, because of its versatility, is the rum plum clafoutis tea. Clafoutis tea is a French dessert, but it sounds fancier than it is. It's a you just whisk together some eggs, some milk, a little bit of flour, a little bit of sugar, and then pour it over whatever type of fruit. And I really like it with plums because plums often, again, are tart enough to stand up to it. But traditionally, it's made with cherries. I've made it with cranberries. I've made it with rhubarb. I've even made it with blueberries. There's lots of different fruit that can balance it, and it's the thing that always comes together when you know how sometimes you get house guests that don't tell you that they're coming when they're coming. And so it's something I can usually pull together with what's in my fridge or freezer.
Abra, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the time and for creating space for us to talk about food every Friday.
That's Abra Behrens. Her latest book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit available here in the Midwest. You can check out the Food Friday recipes Abra shared with us. They're online at wpr.org/foodfriday. And you can share your favorite things to cook or bake with fruit. Send us a note. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it's the State Capitol Report. This week, a look at issues including school safety funding, election laws, and more. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday, we invited you to call in to share your favorite things to do outside now that the weather is warming up. A lot of you called in during the conversation. Here are some more suggestions that you emailed. Karen from Osceola wrote, "Hey, Rob," that's me, "my fave activities this time of year," Karen says, "flower gardening, outdoor campfires," nice, "nighttime stargazing, and a show at the Big Top Chautauqua." Those are great. And Kimberly writes, "I try to get outside during winter to document local parks and preserves, but when the weather warms up, I love to get out to more of a woodlands, more interesting terrain that isn't ice covered. And spring migration," Kimberly writes, "is an absolute highlight. We prepare for the migrants arriving in our backyard habitat right in the city." Thanks so much. Those all sound great. Keep your outdoor activities coming. Email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.